The Athletic.
Good interception by Tanganga. Catches Ayew. Given John Moss a decision. Second yellow is off. And he did lunge in. The fuse was short. And John Moss was right there. And Tottenham Hotspur are down to 10 men.
Yeah, hello everybody, I'm Danny Kelly, I'm your host for the View from the Lane, the Athletic's Tottenham Hotspur podcast. I was going to say I'm joined on the show, but they are the show, aren't they? Both the Athletic's Jack Pitbrook and James Moore to look back on what was a really dismal defeat at Crystal Palace on Saturday. I don't want to become like Arsenal fan TV where everything has to be dealt with in the most hyperbolic and, well, catastrophic of languages. Well, let's hope that this edition of The View from the Lane will be Arsenal fan TV with A-levels. Let's hope for that at the very least. So, James, I'm going to ask you a question that actually just want to, is an invitation to get your feelings about Saturday over to people. The question is the honeymoon for Nuno over, or was there ever actually a honeymoon, or we just go straight back to work after the wedding ceremony?
Oh, no, I think we had a honeymoon, didn't we? I mean, you know, even if it only lasted for 90 minutes against Manchester City, I don't think you can deny that that was a good, well, a result, sort of a good performance. It was certainly good enough anyway. But I don't think this is with the benefit of hindsight. As you say before, performances have definitely got progressively worse. And I know this is an incredibly small sample size of four Premier League matches. But, you know, if you think Manchester City, dogged performance, defended well, largely kept City at arm's length, struck on a counter-attack when they could, had other chances after they'd gone 1-0 up. You know, I don't think anyone could complain about that. Wolves was kind of similar, but against a weaker team and not quite as good a performance. But I still think there's been a little bit of revisionism about this since Saturday afternoon. And I think they played quite well at Wolves. And they probably, even in that game, had the better chances. I don't think Wolves had too many good chances. Maybe just that Traore one-on-one that we talked about the other week. Watford, underwhelming. Didn't have to win the game. Had a couple more chances, but not, you know, not anything to write home about, but this,
James,
was
this is
so
just you pawing the ground. Get after it. Come
so
on.
So awful, wasn't it? It was terrible. And I tweeted after the game, it was one of the worst Premier League performances I could remember from Spurs in the last sort of 10, 15 years, which I think you would say was the kind of top four contention era. And it was, a lot of the people, you know, that replied to that tweet we were talking about, you know, the game against Liverpool at White Hart Lane that they lost 5-0. Which is a game I remember where
Brighton,
there was at least...
The 3-0 at Brighton.
Yeah, the Brighton one. Yeah. The Brighton one, some of Mourinho's later ones, that Liverpool one, which is AVB's last game, they were all kind of the final throes of managerial reigns. And I'm not suggesting Nuno could or should be sacked for this result or anytime imminently. But it is quite ominous, isn't it? It's that kind of performance. And I think you said this over the weekend, Jack. It was the kind of result you expect to see from a team 3 years into a manager's reign when everyone's kind of lost interest and it's all gone a bit stale and you think things are going to need to change. And I suppose we should be quite worried that this is happening now more or less every season with Spurs.
The stats are absolutely damning. I think I'm right in saying that in terms of shots on goal, Spurs are the worst team in the Premier League, despite being top of the table. I mean, those are the anomalies you get at the start of a season. Defensively, they're also conceding an amazing amount of shots on goal. Those aren't necessarily good chances. Did you know, I mean, I knew after 10 minutes they were going to lose this game. I think I knew, but I saw the lineup. I mean, could you believe that he played not just three defensive midfielders in Winks, Skip and Højbjerg, but Dele Alli as well, who's been converted into a running Jobsworth in midfield. I mean, it's an amazing selection.
Yeah, it was. I mean, look, clearly there is some mitigation in terms of the number of players that were missing. And, you know, the circumstances have clearly worked against Spurs and against Nuno in that regard. But, I mean, yeah, you're right, it's such a negative team. Effectively that team was asking for all the creativity to come from the fullbacks, to come from Reguilón and Royale. And, you know, you're playing against Crystal Palace, who the one thing we know for sure is that Wilfried Zaha is going to be their most dangerous player. And obviously he's going to be starting from out wide. You also know that Ayew is going to be incredibly dangerous too. And he's going to be incredibly hardworking and diligent and good at pressing and aggressive in the tackle of defenders and whatever else. And again, maybe this is being wise after the event, but it seems to me like we played a system that played entirely into Palace's hands. It played to their strengths in that regard. Those fullbacks just couldn't get forward at all. So you're left with a flat back four, this kind of narrow midfield, and then Harry Kane up front of Lucas kind of milling around. And, you know, to his credit, Lucas actually did play well. You know, he did his Lucas Moura things that he often does, and there was no one for him to drop the ball off to, or, you know, anyone to exchange the passes with or whatever. But it was just, you know, I tweeted after the game, he started with a system that stops Spurs from being able to create. He didn't change it when it was obvious, you know, as you say, sort of 10, 15 minutes into the game, that they weren't ever even going to get a foothold into that game. And then once they'd gone behind, he didn't even throw caution to the wind and chuck on Hill or Ndombele or even Dane Scarlett.
The worrying thing for me was that the ways in which this game, this performance was bad, it wasn't like, I didn't feel like it was running massively against what Nuno had in mind. Like, obviously they played badly, but the selection was a very Nuno selection. Mm. You know, it was like a terrifying vision of what Nuno Ball could become. Having three defence midfielders, Winks, Skip and Højbjerg, leaving Ndombele on the bench, leaving Brian Keel on the bench, only Dele as a number 10 to create anything. And, you know, we all know that the kind of Nuno plan for this season is to have these three guys in the middle who are only there just for their running power, and they're not really, you know, Tottenham are not planning on creating any chances through midfield, it seems. And this was just a extreme example of that and how bad that could be. It just made me feel like this is a much worse version of what we might see more often if Spurs don't find a way to create chances through the middle.
And then everyone can have a bad day at the office. And I think with the exception of Lucas Moura, who ran around, everybody had a bad day at the office. But Emerson was making his debut against one of the most difficult left-sided wingers in this country. Whereas Reguilón, the more I see of him, I admire his motor up and down the wing. I'm not sure he's got more than a 50% passing accuracy rate. His passing is, I want to say hit and miss, but I feel that the word hit is doing a lot of the yeah. heavy lifting in that set. It's almost random, his passing, and it was terrible. They were, I mean, all the passing, whatever about the selection, whatever about the defensive frailties, whatever about the lack of the actual passing in the team, what do they spend all those hours wearing bibs doing rondos for? They can't get the ball to one to another. It was just appalling.
I mean, I think if you wanted to be incredibly generous, you could say a lot of those players were away during the international break and they probably only had maybe one or two sessions after everyone had returned.
So they've forgotten football,
they? Should have remembered they were wearing white shirts, at least, you would have thought.
What was so damning to me was the isolation of Harry Kane up front. And the match the day afterwards flashed up this graphic showing that I think it was Kane's most isolated ever game, in the sense that he had no shots and no touches in the Palace box. And they showed the five other times it's been almost that bad. So these are games where he's had games when Kane has had no shots and only one or two touches in the opposition box. And of those five games, one of them was against Klopp's Liverpool, and three of them were against Guardiola City. You know, games in which Tottenham were completely dominated. I mean, as it happens, they managed to win one of them 2-0, but games in which Tottenham were completely dominated were so swarmed by the opposition that of course they couldn't get the ball to Kane. This is Crystal Palace. Oh. Against Crystal Palace, like, you know, who did play really, really well on the day.
Yeah.
But a team you would probably expect to finish about 14th or 15th.
Somebody tweeted me after the game, make sure you mention on the, I mean, it's now becoming internationally renowned, View from the Lane podcast, the look on Harry Kane's face. Was he completely disinterested and above all the proceedings? I must have, I'll give him more credit than that. The isolation, as you point out, looked terrible on that heat map. It reminded me, if I might be so bold, many years ago, a woman called Dee Kafari was attempting to become the first woman to row single-handed around the world. She had a radio phone, and in another radio show I used to do, occasionally we would check in with her to see how she was doing. Rowing is a sporting event. And there was one time when she was in the middle of the South Pacific. She was like 3,000 miles from Perth. That would have been the nearest landfall. And I said to her, you realise, Dee, that except for people who are in space, and maybe not even them because they were together, you are now the most isolated human being in the history of the world. Nobody could have been further from human contact than you are right now. I remember, it's terrible. I shouldn't have said it. She cried. she did. She did. Because it hadn't occurred to her. But Harry, I think, was slightly more isolated physically and psychologically at the weekend. Which brings the next problem in. And we'll talk about the defence a little later. When things are going wrong, change something, do something different. And when it was clear, even before the twin calamities of the penalty and the sending off, that Spurs were just doing nothing, why didn't Nuno do something about it? I mean, were they supposed to be playing a diamond? When I saw the selection, I presumed they'd play with Skip at the base with Diamond Alley at the front of it and a narrow front two of Moura and Kane for the fullbacks to get up and support. But I just did. It was just a horrible buzzing around mess, wasn't it? Why didn't he change it? Why didn't he bring on Hill or Ndombele?
I think he was going to bring on Hill just before Tanganga got himself sent off. And maybe he would have made the difference. But for me, the most worrying thing was that lack of kind of comeback or fight in the second half. I mean, anyone can play bad in the first half. But what really annoys me as a fan is when the team don't really look like they're going to make a difference in the second half. That's why the game that it most reminds me of was a different game against City, which is the one that Spurs lost 3-0. I don't know if you remember in January last year, a few months before Mourinho got sacked, where after they conceded the first time, I didn't think there was any commitment from the players to get back into the game. That was probably what felt the most jarring to me, is that we've seen Tottenham play as badly as that in the past, but generally that's been at the end of the Pochettino era and the end of the Mourinho era. Whereas seeing them play like that in the manager's fourth Premier League game in charge is not really something that you would want to see.
When we come back, we'll talk about the role of Japhet Tanganga in all of this and talk about whether or not, and we, as I told you last week, I have got some Puma Kings. I am in line for a recall, at least for the Europa Conference, at centre-back, my old position on Hackney Marshes.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Yeah, you'll listen to The View from the Lane with me, Danny Kelly, Jack Pitbrook and James Moore. If we could be playing Soviet funeral music behind us, we would be doing it. And the tone of the show today is very grim. What do we make, Jack, of Japhet Tanganga's carry-on? Some would say he was a hero for actually getting stuck in. Others, I mean, I don't know where I stand. I'm looking for you here. If that was Granit Xhaka, I'd be demanding he was deported from the country.
Well, I think he deserved to get sent off. You know, he committed two yellow card offences. I think you could argue that Zaha could have been sent off for that initial coming together with Tanganga, just because it looked... I mean, Zaha did come towards Tanganga pretty aggressively. That said, I don't really blame Zaha, because an experienced winger up against a young defender, he's always going to try and get the guy sent off. And that is just part of the game. I think it goes to show that Tottenham do need more experience at centre-back. You know, Tanganga's done well so far, but they will be a better team when Romero comes back from his trip to the Adriatic and gets back into the team, I think. But it was obviously the kind of moment that did cost Tottenham. You know, if Tanganga had stayed on the pitch, then maybe they could have, they would have brought on Brian Gill, maybe they could have brought on Ndombele, and maybe finally tried to pass the ball through the middle of the pitch, which is something they struggled to do before then. So yeah, a bad moment, and one that you can definitely mark down to the sort of lack of experience of playing a game of that intensity, I think.
I actually think Spurs kind of almost paid the price for Tanganga not being sent off directly for the Zaha incident, because to my mind, I think both of those two could have been sent off for that.
I agree.
For the foul, for the initial foul by Tanganga, which was obviously a cynical challenge that you see quite often,
mad.
But he did have his arm like across his kind of, and I don't doubt this was accidental, but he did have his arm across sort of Zaha's throat almost, very near his face, as well as like the kind of clobbering he gave him at like sort of knee level. And then Zaha's reaction is absolutely wild. I mean, Jack, you're saying, he's an experienced winger and he should be used to that, but he didn't react like that was the thing that happened
enough,
to him.
It was really bad, wasn't it?
Every other game, he was pretty wild with his reaction. He was swinging his arms around all over the place, including, like a swipe across Tanganga's face.
Tanganga
quite lucky to avoid a red card there. I think... I mean, the referees decided to give them both a yellow card, and that's usually what we want to see happen in those situations, so we can't really quibble over that. But I think, if either one or other of those two things, but not both, had happened, the player would have been sent off. So if Tanganga had made a clean challenge and Zaha had got up and whacked him, he would have been sent off. Or if Tanganga had done that, semi-rugby tackle, and Zaha just rolled around on the floor, Tanganga would have been sent off.
This is the let it flow Barclays Premier League of 2021.
And I'm all for that, I've got to be honest. I wouldn't have wanted them sent off for that. There was no obvious punch. It was a stupid tackle by Tanganga, who I think was just about fed up with the sight of Wilf coming at him. But I'm afraid that's what you get with Crystal Palace. I saw mixed reports on how Emerson did. He saw a lot of the back of Wilfred Zaha because he was trying to get forward himself. But of course, the service to him from Tottenham's battalion of square passing midfielders.
Is there a collective noun for three sideways passes?
A tedium? A blockhouse, a tedium, I don't know, something very concrete and uncreative, a powerhouse of central midfielders, with all due respect to the great architect. Let's talk about the defence. You've got the gang in Croatia. You get an injury to Dyer, caused, because everything was wrong on the day, by a terrible kick out by the goalkeeper, which forced Dyer into a sort of 50-50. You get Tanganga sent off, and you're down to the fifth and sixth choice centre-backs. And he must have at that stage been wondering why he didn't have Maxim, the Estonian fella, whose surname I'm still practising to correctly pronounce, on the bench. And I'm not sure, does anyone know which of these are going to be available, quarantined, fit and unsuspended for the Chelsea game? I dread to think.
I mean, so I think Romero and Sanchez will fly back from Croatia on this Friday. I think that would be, at which point they will have been out of the red list country for 10 days, which means they can come in without having to do a hotel quarantine. So I think Spurs will be desperately trying to get one of them on the pitch, because otherwise it will be Rodon and Davis up against Lukaku and co. on Sunday, which I'm a bit, nobody would want to see, I think.
Oh, I think the RSPCA would stop that. That would be cruelty, wouldn't it? You can't have that.
Would there be logic in playing both Sanchez and Romero together, given they spent the entire week together? Like, I mean, I'm being sort of semi-serious. Like, would it make sense just to chuck them both in, given
maybe
they might just have that slight...
Romero doesn't speak any English, so Romero and Sanchez might be a better pair than Romero and Davis or Romero and Rodon.
And also, a little birdie tells me that Romero's got quite a good record of... and the little birdie's name is Charlie Eccleshare, by the way, I should say that. Romero has quite a good record when it comes to keeping Lukaku quiet.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
You can definitely get Romero and chucking him in.
Personally speaking, I would pick them both. I want to suspend them both for 6 months, but needs must where the devil drives. I mean, they'll have to play. They're the best centre-backs that are available. As I said last week, and I stand to be proven wrong, I've yet to be convinced by Joe Rodon. He tries hard, and he's clearly a willing enough fella, and he's got the requisite amount of tattoos to be a top modern player, but I'm still not sure about him. And Davis in a two, it's just not right, is it? He's probably his very, very best position, is left side centre-back in a three, as he's played so often for Wales. I don't suppose we're going to three centre-backs and three defensive midfielders, but I wouldn't put it past Nuno. We'll talk about what you're expecting from Chelsea next up, but as I say, thank you for just giving me some information there, because it's dreadful trying to think of a team if the famous three don't get back and at least two of them get in and around the team. And it's annoying too. Two things are even more annoying away from this result at Selhurst Park. Lo Celso's performances for Argentina have been fantastic, or at least very, very good. Better than any game he's put in for Spurs. You could argue he's in a better midfield. You could definitely argue that. And secondly, it can't have failed to pass people's notice over the weekend that Jose Mourinho's Roma were involved in an end-to-end brilliant game against Sassuolo. It was his 1,000th game in charge of a club side, and scored a 97th-minute winner that takes them top of Serie A, while baby Jose skulks in the dugout at Spurs, unwilling to make any positive changes.
When I said that Spurs' performance at Crystal Palace reminded me of some of the last days of Mourinho's time at Tottenham, I was accused by someone who used to work for Mourinho of having him living rent-free in my head.
I saw that. That phrase, geezer, some of us have got enough room in our heads we could think about things without charging rent. Of course, the ghost of Mourinho, the shadow of Mourinho, the stain of Mourinho hangs over the club currently. And I've got nothing against him personally. As I say, the time I've spent with him personally, he's been perfectly fine.
Me too.
Just
me
don't
too.
Like the way he played. Don't like the way he played football at Spurs. That's okay to say. I saw that comment there, and I'm glad you brought it up. It gives a chance to slag off somebody I don't even know.
Having brought Mourinho into the conversation, I just want to put on record that I think that performance was like a sort of a caricature of a Mourinho performance, really. Like, even if the worst performances at Spurs, it was like, it was amped up to about 200. I mean, honestly, as you say, Danny, you know, the idea that you play three defensive midfielders away to Crystal Palace and just expect us to kind of just for a goal just to go in off Harry Kane's backside without the ball actually even going anywhere near him. I mean, it's absolutely bewildering. And you know, this isn't me saying Nuno should be sacked. As I say, we're not that fickle.
It was quite a bit like the infamous Dinamo Zagreb opposition manager in prison 3-0 defeat. You know, which is probably the worst single game under Mourinho.
That was certainly the worst single game under Nuno. And we'll ask ourselves whether it's been coming, because there were some very interesting comments under Charlie's piece in The Athletic. Subscribers have been debating where the decline started at Spurs. We'll talk about that in just a second.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Yes, we've been trying to drag ourselves through the slough of despond surrounding Tottenham's horrible looking defeats at Selhurst Park at the weekend. Charlie Eccleshare wrote a piece in the Athletic about it, and it was interesting. Subscribers to The Athletic were able to have their say about it, and two players in particular got mentioned, but I think it's talking about a malaise in general. Somebody said that the matches like the abomination at Selhurst Park are a stark reminder of how much we've fallen off since the departure of Christian Eriksen. It just seemed like we completely lack his vision and guile in the current squad. Let me get the name for that. That was Jaideep K. Gary S. said Dembele leaving was the beginning of the decline. Spurs' league form was dreadful as soon as he left, and it was only disguised by their run to the Champions League final. Look, I had a rant about this on my radio show as well. The truth is the and I'm going to use this word, and come at me if you want with your rent-free and all the rest of it. The great team of 2016, and it is 5 years ago now, has gradually been allowed to drift away, and in no position have the players that have left been replaced by better players, whether that's the stadium, whether it's recruitment. And so, of course, James, we're going to have nostalgia fests for the like of Moussa Dembele and the like of Christian Eriksen.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably safe to say, and maybe some people will disagree with this, I don't think a single player that's left from that team, that kind of 15, 16, 17 team, mm-hmm. has been replaced by someone who you definitely say will definitely be, or could definitely be, like in Tottenham's first team for the next 5 or 6 years, or for the next cycle, you know, of success,
sure,
if they have that.
Sure.
You know, but, you know, people like Højbjerg may be the closest, but, you know, I think probably since, like, the turn of the year, he's probably not played especially well for Spurs. We know he played very well for Denmark, and that's maybe a different problem that they need to solve, similar to Lo Celso, as you say, Jack. They basically haven't managed to sign a player. I mean, maybe I'm doing someone a disservice here. Tell me if I'm forgetting someone, but to me, off the top of my head, I don't think they've signed someone who's a 100% surefire hit and is definitely going to be in a team for the next, or they're going to have to be batting off interest from Real Madrid and Barcelona, say, like they would have done before.
No, you're absolutely not. You think that a club of Tottenham's size, or, you know, any club doing their recruitment properly at their own level, you would have at least 50% hit rate at the moment, with the exception of Højbjerg, who might become an absolute staple. They just are not bringing in, whether it's finances, whatever it is, players to go back to that great team. But soon we're going to have to forget about that great team, because what we have now is the here and now, and a team that's facing into the future, I think, in a rather uncertain way. How important do you think Christian Eriksen's departure was, Jack?
Oh, massively. Eriksen and Dembele, I think, are two. I mean, I think Dembele is a kind of unique player. I can't really think of any other comparison to him.
Total like one-off.
When they got in Ndombele, people said, oh, Ndombele is going to be the new Dembele. And I think there was a bit of, you know, like laziness there, because he's really not on this. I love watching Ndombele. He's not on the same level as Moussa Dembele. Like, Dembele's ability to hold onto the ball under pressure, to allow the rest of Tottenham players to find the right position, to escape opposition challenges, to dictate the tempo of the game was unbelievable. And Eriksen is just a brilliantly intelligent, creative, not quite an old school number 10, but very, very good at creating those chances and helping to link the whole of the team together. So those two guys did so much work, and Tottenham haven't really, as much, you know, Lo Celso, again, fantastic player, but he's played well for Tottenham, 10 times ever?
If that.
And the same goes for Ndombele. So between, it's 2 years, more than 2 years now since Spurs signed Ndombele and Lo Celso. And the reality is they have not come close to kind of scratching the sides of replacing Dembele and Eriksen in midfield for Tottenham. Like, Tottenham haven't been consistently good in midfield since, what, the first half of the 2018-19 season?
They started to rely and have now increasingly relied on Kane and Son to do all the creative work between them.
Completely,
and of course, their astonishing production of both in goals and assists has covered over the cracks. But other managers aren't fooled. If you can keep the ball away from Spurs' front two, you get the freedom of the field. I mean, it was what I had to say. Watching Conor Gallagher the weekend, it took him 15 minutes to realise that Spurs were no good and that he could literally stand between the lines, dictate the game.
It's almost 3 years since they sold Dembele. In January, it's going to be 3 years since they sold Dembele. And to be honest, it was around then that I think Eriksen's form started to decline. Like, Eriksen didn't really do... I love Eriksen. He didn't do that much towards like the Champions League final run. And he certainly didn't do very much after that, given that, you know, there was talk of him leaving in 2019 and it never happened. So it's a long time now since Eriksen and Dembele were running the midfield for Tottenham, and they've fallen a long way in that period. And they don't look like getting back there, I think, at the moment.
We've talked about this a million times before, but the problem is, as I see it, in 2018 when they didn't sign anybody, that's when they should have been like saying, well, look, Dembele, they knew Dembele wanted to leave and they managed to get another year out of him. They knew Eriksen only had, 2 years at that point left in his contract and was possibly going to want to leave. So that was going to be a situation they don't need to manage. 2018 is when they should have gone out and thought, we need to put our succession plan in place. We need to work out who the next one or two players are that we want to add creativity to this midfield. And obviously they signed nobody. I can't remember, was there someone that summer they tried to sign?
Grealish,
I guess.
That was the Grealish summer.
Yeah, okay, well, there you go. What's he
And for the sake of £4.5 million, they didn't sign him. It's looking pretty bad now, isn't it? It's looking pretty bad. At this stage, I would normally say, let's try and raise the gloom by looking forward to the next performance. We'll do a bit more of this on Thursday, but the next Premier League game Spurs play is against little old Chelsea, the champions of Europe. How much are you looking forward to seeing Chelsea roll up to North London, James, in a few days' time?
Not a lot, really. I can't say I'm relishing that. A mate of mine is a Chelsea fan, messaged me over the weekend and said, do you want to go for a drink beforehand? I'm like, I mean, it's the last thing I want to do is go and meet any Chelsea fans and have a conversation with them. I just want
to drinking afterwards, but not before.
I just want to pretend it's not happening outside that 90 minutes. I mean, look, it's incredibly ominous, isn't it? Chelsea with Lukaku and the team look incredibly strong, and obviously they're already champions of Europe before that, so they weren't exactly in bad shape. It's the kind of game that should play into to Nuno's hands, isn't it? You think, you know, like the City game, the opportunity to sit deep, sit players behind the ball, just hope they can frustrate Chelsea. I think that will kind of be deemed acceptable by the crowd. I don't think it's going to be one of those games where sitting in and playing quite conservatively is going to be like met with howls of derision from the stands. So actually playing two centre-backs and three defensive midfielders, if they have to do that again or if they choose to do that again,
more,
I don't think it's necessarily going to be the worst. More. How many do you want?
Well, Dele Alli can sit in kind of libero as well. Let's have
in there. Yeah.
Well, thank you for finding a ray of at least theoretical positivity that the way Chelsea will be pushing Spurs back might suit Spurs. Any immediate thoughts, Jack, on what might happen against Chelsea?
I just think Chelsea just look like kind of ominously, intimidatingly good at the moment. They never concede chances. They're very difficult to get at. There's no Achilles heel there. And they've got brilliant creative players. They're very strong in midfield and they've got a world-class number nine. So I think Nuno's got his work cut out.
This has been a very gloomy version of The View from the Lane. And I can't help but thinking what would normally be a piece of rather sprightly news is also, in its own way, negative. The Spurs Stadium, that beautiful edifice, that space station on the Tottenham High Road, has been shortlisted for, I think it's actually won an award and been shortlisted for an even bigger one. But even I now, the way things are in my mind at the moment, I just see that as the stadium trolling Harry Kane about trophies. Inanimate objects are now winning more trophies than Harry Kane. And the manager has got manager of the month. He's got another trophy. Well done to the stadium, but it's no consolation for what's gone on this week, is it?
I mean, it's pretty damning, isn't it, really? That, you know, and it's probably an indication of what the club's priorities have been over the last sort of 4 or 5 years. And we talked about that 2018 window when they didn't sign anyone. And obviously part of that would have been, you know, saving money because they were building the stadium. So I guess those two things do kind of tie together, really.
Just bouncing off that, if you were, because he's got such a high profile, if you were Paratici watching that performance, How busy would you be on your multiplicity of mobile phones even now, looking forward to January?
How much of the problem is the squad, though?
It's not a big enough squad, is it? They're definitely a couple of players short. I mean, even if those, what is it, seven players were available, there isn't that creative midfield player, is there? Unless you think it's going to be Lo Celso or Ndombele.
They've got some creative midfielders, Ndombele, Lo Celso, and Brian Gill. They're just not in the team.
It's better than nothing, which obviously is what they had on Saturday. But like, there isn't an obvious player there you look at and say, if he's in the team, all the problems are solved.
And equally, if they were, before the sending off, if they want to change it and go to a two up front, and I'm not including Son, I still think he's better out wide, they still... You talked about the period of times that they haven't replaced, particularly... And Dembele, when someone remind me, I might miss somebody coming and going, the sort of ghost of Soldado. When was the last time Spurs actually signed an out-and-out striker on a permanent?
When they signed Llorente, 2017?
I guess Llorente.
Get Llorente back in, get it launched.
He's a free agent, isn't he, Llorente?
I think he is.
And launching it would at least guarantee a touch or two in the opposition penalty area, which they couldn't even manage
at
Crystal Palace. And I suspect might be few and far between against Chelsea as well.
Shit, apparently he's just signed for Udinese. No, in January he signed for Udinese, Llorente. So he's not a free agent. Yeah. Shows what I know.
Top journalism.
Yeah. And so if you've enjoyed this particularly gloomy edition of The View from the Lane, look forward to Thursdays, when the preview of the game against Chelsea might be equally dark and brooding, never mind next Mondays after what unfolds at White Hart Lane. Thank you very much, Jack, and thank you very much, James, for all your help. And if you're not already a subscriber, you can read the article we talked about with Charlie and much else besides, looking back at that game against Crystal Palace, by going to theathletic.com/SpursPod. And right now, you can sign up with a 33% discount on a full subscription. We'll be back on Thursday, as I said, with a big preview of the triumph against Chelsea this weekend. Thank you all for listening.
The Athletic.